One Illinois resident has been confirmed dead, another reportedly killed in severe weather and likely tornadoes that swept throughout the Midwest last night. Today, we'll check in throughout the state from Ottawa in LaSalle County all the way down to White County in southern Illinois to see how they're doing. Also, with one in four doctors in the U.S. from other countries, what has the Trump administration's actions on immigration done to impact health care? Many in the medical community are concerned that the shortage of doctors who serve rural and low-income areas will get even worse. We'll talk to the dean of Southern Illinois University School of Medicine. Plus, Bloomington-based State Farm lost more money insuring cars last year than they ever have. What's going on?
It's the cost they're higher, and there's more accidents, and clearly, I think distracted driving is probably the single biggest factor.
Crane Chicago business reporter Steve Daniel joins us. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone is safe this morning. A number of reported tornadoes across the state yesterday evening killed at least two people. The storms moved in during the afternoon and overnight. Dozens were hurt. Many buildings were damaged or destroyed from the town of Ottawa, about an hour and a half southwest of Chicago, to areas in southern Illinois, from the St. Louis, Missouri area to close to Evansville, Indiana. As those communities clean up, the National Weather Service is sending crews to assess the damage and confirm the tornadoes and their strength. Governor Bruce Rauner activated the State Emergency Operations Center ahead of the storms yesterday. This morning, the governor is in LaSalle County, where one death was reported in Ottawa. Captain David Gualandry is with the Ottawa Police Department and described what happened to the victim there.
They happened to be outside performing some work task when the storm hit. They weren't apparently not able to seek shelter in a timely fashion. One was injured and one was confirmed deceased.
Another person likely killed in the storms was in southern Illinois near Evansville, Indiana. And we're going to check in with the White County Sheriff's Department later on in the hour. And of course, you can stay with this public media station for updates throughout the day. When President Trump's executive order on immigration was put in place last month, one of the concerns raised by many in the healthcare industry was that restricting the flow of immigrants from the seven countries listed in the travel ban could exacerbate a shortage of primary care doctors, especially doctors that serve in rural or low-income areas. Roughly one in four doctors in the U.S. come from other countries, and the American Medical Association, in a statement reacting to the travel ban, pointed out that immigrant doctors in particular play a crucial role in serving in rural and low-income areas. We're joined now by Dr. Jerry Cruz. He's dean and provost of the Southern Illinois University School of Medicine. Dr. Cruz, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me this morning.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Dr. Cruz, according to one study that we were looking at, a 2016 study by the Association of American Medical Colleges, there's currently a deficit of about 8,200 primary care doctors and 2,800 psychiatrists in the U.S. Do you have a sense that this will get worse if this travel ban restricts foreign-born doctors from entering the U.S.?
Well, first of all, I'd say that those numbers are probably low. Those shortages are greater than you mentioned.
Wow.
There. And also, yes, you know, the healthcare system the healthcare education system that we've developed is one that does produce somewhere between 15% and 25% doctors who are born in foreign countries. They're an integral part of that system, and certainly the primary care coverage would be hurt if there was an immigration ban.
Dr. Cruz, can we talk about Illinois in particular and what it looks like for us across our state? Do we have a shortage of doctors in rural areas?
We do have a shortage of doctors in rural areas. Actually, the shortage of doctors is defined best by the Council on Graduate Medical Education of the Department of Health and Human Service federally. That's the best planning organization for physician workforce. They don't focus on other healthcare professionals, but just physicians. And they've very clearly shown that the shortages that we have are in primary care, family medicine, general internal medicine, geriatrics. There are shortages in all types of psychiatry, geriatric, general, and child psychiatry. And we're getting growing shortages now in general surgery and pediatric subspecialties as well. We have good evidence that these very types of shortages that the Council on Graduate Medical Education has identified are also operative in the state of Illinois, too.
Dr. Chris, there may be a feeling from some people that they don't understand why these jobs can't be held by Americans. And I wonder, or people who are born in this country, and I wonder, what does it look like when we think about the need and how many people who are born in the U.S. are going to medical school? Are there enough people entering now, or is this a shortage that has traditionally for a long time been held by people who are coming from other countries to work here?
Yeah, it's a long, long tradition right now, and I guess tradition may not be the right word. It's just the system that has developed. For some period of time, there was clearly a shortage of medical students that were produced by United States medical schools, but we've really ramped that up in the past two decades. Actually, the current the medical schools that were in operation 20 years ago are now producing at least 10% more physicians than they did at that time. And also, since the year 2000, we have about 40 new schools of medicine and osteopathy in the United States, too. And you put those things together, and we have had about a 20% increase in U.S.-born medical students who graduate from U.S. medical schools. But here are the numbers on the postgraduate training. Now, you know, medical students have to go to residency programs or fellowships in order to get their specialty training, even their specialty training in primary care. And so we have about 28,000 positions a year for residency training right out of medical school. We have about 18,000 graduates from U.S. medical schools every year. And then we fill the other spots, 3,000 with doctors of osteopathy, 3,000 with U.S. citizens who are trained in foreign countries, and about 4,000 foreign-born international medical graduates, which again is running at about 15%. When we look at the numbers, and we look at the numbers of applicants from the United States into medical school, it really looks like only about 1,000 or 2,000 of those who don't get in might be qualified applicants. So there's no way we could fill that 10,000 physician gap with the current number of students who are applying to U.S. medical schools. It just wouldn't happen.
So there's not a sense that there are people who are applying and they're competing with foreign students and they're not getting in. That's not happening.
Well, there are some, but it doesn't seem to be a major significant problem. There is a little bit of that, but we could not fill all of those spots with U.S. applicants at this point. It would take some number of years, maybe even decades, to get to that point.
Mm-hmm. You know, as you mentioned students, I'm thinking about Senator Durbin brought a guest with him last night to President Trump's joint address to Congress. It was actually a medical student at Loyola University in Chicago. They say they were the first medical school in the country to welcome DACA, that's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival Students. Her name's Aima Saeed. She's a dreamer. She was brought here from Pakistan when she was three. I want to just play a little piece of a conversation she had on Facebook Live with Senator Durbin.
You have about 25 or 30 fellow students at Loyola Medical School who are in the same situation.
Yeah.
And what do they say?
They have a lot of anxiety. They have a lot of fears. So they're just hoping for the best, but definitely they're scared.
That's Aima talking about her colleagues who are also medical students who are dreamers. And she went on to explain how she's agreed to work in an underserved area in Illinois after she graduates.
I basically agreed to do 4 years of service in an underserved or rural area in Illinois. And so that I would do that after my training, after I complete my residency.
So it's kind of a bargain.
Yeah.
We help you get educated, you become a doctor, then come back to help us in parts of Illinois where we don't have enough doctors.
Yeah, but it's a pretty nice bargain if you ask me.
That's Aima Saeed. She's a medical student at Loyola University in Chicago, a dreamer, talking to Senator Durbin, of course, author of the DREAM Act. Dr. Cruz, when you hear Aima's story, I wonder when you look at your medical school, when you think about Southern Illinois University, about the issue of dreamers, how much of that is part of the equation we haven't talked about yet? Because we've been sort of talking about the travel ban. We haven't talked about students who may have, or young people who may have been brought here as children who may be dreamers or deferred action who also want to go to medical school.
Well, that certainly resonates with me. We need people like her, for sure, and we need programs like the one that Senator Durbin described. I don't know particularly what the situation is at the Southern Illinois University School of Medicine in our residency programs, but I do know that of our 330 resident physicians and fellows, 25% are foreign-born. They bring a rich cultural diversity and heritage and bring great advantages to our School of Medicine and to the care of our patients, for sure. And I would like to give them every advantage to fill those spots to treat medically vulnerable people and people who just don't have the greatest chance for medical care throughout the state of Illinois.
And I wonder for you, when we think about not just dreamers, questions about, we know we've heard some news in the past 24 hours about what President Trump is going to do in terms of the executive order regarding the previously now overturned travel ban. But are you worried about all of this conversation, whether it's about dreamers or students or the travel ban and immigrants? Are you concerned that people might even decide to not apply to medical school or for residency or for finding jobs within the U.S., foreign-born doctors?
We are absolutely concerned about them applying for residency programs. You know, just the threat of that will already have a negative effect that will last for years to come. You know, I think when the immigration ban was first announced, my cell phone was buzzing and ringing like crazy from people who were concerned about this, and not only from the seven countries. There's worry that it will be expanded to other countries. Countries on that list for countries originating terrorist activities. And so we've actually had to deal with a fair number of our residents and faculty members who wanted to travel or who had spouses or children who wanted to come in, and we've advised them not to do that travel right now. So there's a significant degree of uncertainty at the moment, which does affect applications for the future without question. And we would like to see this resolved as quickly as possible for all people.
And when you think about the long-term effects also, one of our producers was reading a story in Stat News about an Iranian medical student at UIC, the University of Illinois in Chicago, saying being worried about systemic discrimination against foreign-born doctors. Is that a concern also? I imagine part of the phone, that's a medical doctor, actually, a resident at UIC. Is that a concern also, I imagine? Are you hearing that from your residents?
I will just say this, that we have a very broad conversation and a number of programs at the Southern Illinois University School of Medicine that focus on equity, diversity, and inclusion. And so we know that it relates to the question that you asked me, and we know that it relates to other issues related to race, for sure. I will just tell you that we're focusing in on that, and we're getting our faculty and residents and students trained in dismantling systemic racism. We think that is very, very important for our institution going forward, and we would hope that all institutions, medical schools and institutions of higher learning, would follow that cue as we move forward.
Dr. Cruz, as you think about SIU School of Medicine, as you think about this whole issue of rural health care, how do you want people who are outside of what you are doing on a daily basis to think about this, the role that immigrant doctors are playing throughout most of the state? Because where we're looking particularly in smaller towns or more rural areas or in poor areas.
Okay, so the SIU School of Medicine, when it was founded in 1970, one of our foundational principles was social accountability to a defined population. That's the 66 southwesternmost counties in the state of Illinois, 2.2 million people, and as I said, 66 counties. Since SIU has been here, we've graduated about 2,500 resident physicians and fellows and a comparable number of medical students. And a large percentage of them have settled in that 66-county area. Again, I can't give you the specific numbers of those that are foreign-born. They're just part of the fabric of our institution. They're part of our core values, for sure. But those doctors that I mentioned and the whole complement of those doctors make up the heart and soul of medical care in 35,000 square miles of the state of Illinois. And I would want everybody to understand that and understand that every one of those doctors is important to the healthcare system and that they help the population have better access to care, better healthcare outcomes, and actually help lower the cost for healthcare.
And would you say that's probably true across most rural areas across the country, not just in Illinois?
You know, I think it probably is. I don't know the data as well for other states, but I would say by and large for pretty much every state that would be true.
And Dr. Cruz, what's your hope that the Trump administration will do when they release these new orders?
Well, my hope would be that they would be just and fair and recognize the importance that the immigrant population has had to the United States historically and recently. You know, I know that I'm thinking about the doctors for the people that we serve, but it goes well beyond just the physicians. It goes to all people who are in this situation right now. And I just I just hope for, again, equity, justice, and fairness.
Dr. Jerry Cruz is Dean and Provost of Southern Illinois University's School of Medicine. He's also the CEO of SIU Healthcare. Dr. Cruz, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thanks so much.
Coming up on the 21st, all this week we've been talking about sexual assault, sexual violence on college campuses. Today, in our final conversation, we turn our attention to Title IX. So stay tuned for that. You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and you're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. We're continuing our series we've been doing this week about sexual assault on college campuses. On Monday, we talked to students, particularly at Northwestern University, who are trying to improve resources for survivors of sexual violence. Yesterday, we learned about sexual harassment when it happens at the graduate student level. Today, for about the next 15 minutes, we're going to be talking about Title IX. That's a federal law that prohibits discrimination on the basis of gender at any educational institution that receives federal funding. Over the past few years, the Obama administration enforced Title IX in part as a way to combat sexual assault at universities. And we want to talk about how this law will affect the way colleges approach sexual harassment and sexual assault. Joining me to discuss this is Catherine Baker. She's a law professor at Chicago Kent College of Law at the Illinois Institute of Technology. And on the line all the way from Northern Alaska, Bree Van Dam runs the Environmental Data Center at the Tulik Field Station with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She's also part of a team that develops policies and procedures to combat sexual harassment and sexual assault at the field station. Catherine, Bree, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bree, I don't think we've had anyone for, I think you win the prize for the farthest guest we've ever had on the air here.
Oh, that's great. I'm
for
glad.
The 21st. Can you, we talked yesterday about, Bree, we'll tweet out a link to that conversation with Kate Clancy, who's an anthropologist, about the research she's done about sexual harassment, sexual assault, when it occurs sort of at a graduate student level, when they're especially scientists who are working out in the field. What kind of work do you do at the Environmental Data Center? I imagine the work that you do is a pretty remote field operation, a lot of the stuff that you all do.
Yeah, so the Tulik Field Station, we're a remote scientific research station. Our focus is to support research and education to create a greater understanding of the Arctic and its relationship to the global environment. So we're located over 100 miles north of the Arctic Circle, so you can imagine it's pretty difficult to get in and out. So that creates a pretty isolated community, which can be awesome because it creates, you know, the sort of small group of people who work really closely and share information. But yeah, it's about a 9-hour drive north from Fairbanks to get to the field station, and there's no really easier way out than that.
So it's a 9-hour drive in and out.
Yep.
Wow. How long have you been up there?
I've been working there for about 4 years.
Okay.
And before that, I was actually a graduate student doing a research project there.
Oh, okay. And so with your experience, what are some of the keys to creating an environment? You said that's a great place to do research, but then I also imagine if it's a place where when you're working remotely like that, if there's a difficult situation, that may make things very hard.
It does, yeah. And so we're really conscious of that and try to create as safe a place as we can. And so our approach has been to take a multifaceted approach. So we try and talk to people, kind of create an open dialogue, and we try and reach people before they arrive at Tulip Field Station. And to do that, we have a mandatory training related to sexual misconduct that everyone who comes to Tulip Field Station, including staff members, graduate students, undergraduate students, senior researchers, everybody has to take that training. And we're aware that trainings aren't always the most effective way to reach people, but it does a couple of things. So it exposes all of our visitors to our code of conduct. It also makes all of the consequences and expectations for behaviors transparent. And it gives sort of clear examples of inappropriate behaviors and also sets the tone before people even come to TULIC that respect and safety are a priority for us.
Mm-hmm.
And it also provides a bunch of resources, so like confidential resources, hotlines people can call, resources at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and TULIC-specific resources. So that's one way, and then we try and reach people as soon as they get to the field station. So everyone goes through an orientation when they arrive at the field station, which goes from, you know, talks about everything from water use to living in that remote environment. And we also mention our sexual misconduct policy during that orientation. And then during their stay, we have a bunch of different outreach type options that we're kind of constantly evaluating and working on. A few of those examples are we screened the movie The Hunting Ground a couple of times and then had sort of an open dialogue afterwards. And then several of us are trained in the Green Dot Bystander Intervention Training Program. So bystander intervention training is one way that we try and reach people and encourage people who see something happening to act. And then so we're constantly looking for new ways to reach people, and we have resources posted everywhere around camp so that if anything does happen, they have a place to call.
Wow. Yeah,
or they know their options.
Yeah, it sounds really thorough. Catherine, I wonder when we think about when you're hearing everything that they do at the Tulik Field Station, how does that compare to what most universities do for Title IX? Can you remind us what Title IX is and what the requirements are that universities have to follow?
So Title IX is the anti-sex discrimination law that applies to educational institutions from kindergarten through graduate school, and it prohibits sex discrimination, and that runs the gamut from refusing to hire a woman because she's a woman for some philosophy professorship to making sure that women have opportunity to play sports, to making sure women don't have to go to school in environments that are sexually harassing. And so we're talking about it here because Title IX has been interpreted to prohibit sexual harassment in educational environments. And it sounds, right, what Bree was describing as a really thorough, fantastic program that is proactive and probably does a great deal towards preventing harassing behavior from ever manifesting itself. I was struck, though, maybe in part by the 9-hour drive, by how there's a little bit of necessity being the mother of invention there, probably, because everyone, I think, would be sympathetic to how horrendous it would be to be a woman at a very, very remote scientific station being the subject to sort of constant harassing behavior from a superior, right? That would be a very, very compelling Title IX case. The problem everywhere else, the problem in your standard university setting, is the harassment is much more diffuse. And when it's easier for women to walk away, or when it's perceived that it's easier for women to walk away, there is a lot less consensus that it's actually harassing conduct when men refuse to take no for an answer.
And Catherine, you said something interesting I want to go back to. You said that Title IX has been interpreted to be related to preventing sexual harassment. Do you have a sense that that was an interpretation that the Obama administration had that may not happen in subsequent administrations?
No. That's the Supreme Court has said that.
Okay.
So that law is perfectly good law. That law is not changing. What the Obama administration did through the Department of Education and through the Office of Civil Rights at the Department of Education is interpret what the fact that schools have a responsibility to prevent sexual harassment actually means in practice, right? So the Supreme Court has said Title IX applies to schools, and because Title IX applies to schools, that means people have the right to be free from sexually harassing environments. What the Obama administration said is, this is the way we are defining certain kinds of sexually harassing environments. And part of what they said is that when women are and women or men are forced to engage in non-consensual sexual activity, and when that kind of male entitlement to non-consensual sexual activity goes unpunished, that constitutes a sexually harassing environment. So I think it's unlikely that the current Department of Education will continue that push, continue that pressure on schools to rigorously try and root out all those forms of sexual harassment. But I think it's perfectly likely that a bunch of schools will continue to do that on their own.
So you said something that I want to come back to. You said you think it's unlikely that this will continue in the Trump administration. I just
yes.
want to be clear about that. You do think
yes.
that. Why do you think that?
Because it was controversial enough in the previous administration. And so I think it's very unlikely that under that the powers that be in the current administration are going to say, you know how we should spend our resources? We should go after schools to tell them to really enforce against male predatory behavior. I don't think there's anything coming out of this administration that would reasonably make us think that they were particularly concerned about male predatory behavior. I think that lots and lots of universities are of their own accord, and I think they'll try to continue to institute the kinds of programs that Bree was talking about. But I don't think it's going to come from this Department of Education.
That's Catherine Baker. She's a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law at the Illinois Institute of Technology. We're also speaking with Bree Van Diem, who manages the Environmental Data Center at the Tulik Field Station at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. As she's telling us, it's about a 9-hour drive north of Fairbanks. Bree, as you're listening to this, I wonder how Title IX affects your work. Do you all feel that you've kind of, it sounds like you all have a culture where you've sort of already begin instituted all of these things apart from just the legal compliance with Title IX?
Yeah, we have. And I think we understand that this is that, you know, changing the culture around sexual misconduct is not something that has a finite end goal, right? So we're going to continue our efforts sort of no matter what changes happen at the federal level because we believe it's the right thing to do. And so within the field station, we have the ability to take either immediate or, immediate action to ensure the safety of all of our residents. So that can look anything like, you know, mediation between parties, so changing laboratory assignments, up to removal from the field station. And those are immediate actions that we can take to ensure safety. And then in the long term is when an investigation occurs, and that we rely on the University of Alaska Fairbanks Title IX office for those investigations, unless it, of course, could go to the police as well.
Bree, have you ever had to kick people out of the field station?
Yes, people have been removed from the field station.
So that has happened. And do you feel like the fact that you all have done that and sort of handled that within the station, apart from it escalating to sort of the Title IX office, or maybe it does anyway, do you think that really sets a tone and makes everyone understand what you're talking about, that you not just have a code of conduct, but you actually enforce it?
I think it's really important to have clear and consistent consequences for the behavior, for that type of behavior. And again, they don't all, you know, obviously removal from camp is not the first thing that we jump to. and I also want to make clear that all staff members and the management team at the Tulik Field Station are mandatory reporters to the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So everything does get connected to UAS Title IX office.
Catherine, does this setup that Bree's talking about, is this a common setup across universities in Illinois or around the country? What she's saying, is it common?
I think that no. Sorry, to give you a simpler answer,
yeah.
I think I'm going to say no.
Right.
I think that part of the issue that schools are struggling with right now is the kinds of punishment that are appropriate. So I was struck by how Bree sort of immediately said, well, you know, it can be everything from mediation to changing lab partners to removal from campus. And there has been a tendency among schools, and I think in fairness, there were some people in the previous Department of Education who seemed to suggest that kicking someone out of the school is, you know, the only legitimate punishment. Some people said that. Not everybody said that. I want to be very clear that the official position of the Obama administration was not any offender has to be kicked out. But there were various stories about how that message was being sent in a somewhat more nuanced fashion. I think it is precisely because people seemed to see the punishment issue in fairly binary terms. Either he gets kicked out or nothing happens to him. Either he's guilty and he gets kicked out, or he's innocent and he stays and nothing happens to him, has been a big part of the problem, because many women actually don't come forward because they don't think he should get kicked out. That seems too drastic to them, but they want the behavior to stop, but they don't know what to do because they don't necessarily want him to get kicked out. Ideas like mediation, solutions like changing classroom schedules, changing dorms, things like that, they're not costless for universities. I mean, it's a pain in the neck to change someone's classroom schedule or have them switch dormitories. But I think that the more schools can embrace alternative forms of punishment, alternative forms of recognition of the problem, the easier it will be to deal with the problem in a more comprehensive way.
We just have about a minute or two left, Bree, and I just want to ask you, as you've been listening to Catherine talk about this, about her sort of lack of optimism in terms of what's going to happen at the federal level, I imagine this isn't even your regular day job, Bree, to be doing all of these things that we're talking about, right? Because
that's true.
You manage the Environmental Data Center. We haven't even talked about all of that. But obviously, this is something you care very deeply about. Do you feel optimistic about the future, maybe apart from what you all are doing in Alaska, about how this looks across the country?
I do not have a lot of hope that our current president, who joked about sexual assault, will prioritize this issue in the administration. So in that sense, I don't have much hope. But I think it's been really amazing to work with this community at the Tulip Field Station. And so I think I have a lot of hope that different communities, universities, and institutions can take initiative and do this kind of work because it is the right thing to do, not because they are mandated by the federal government.
Thanks for joining me. Bree Van Dam manages the Environmental Data Center at the Tulip Field Station at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Catherine Baker is a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law at the Illinois Institute of Technology. Ladies, thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
I should mention to everyone, as we've been having these conversations, if you or someone you know needs help, the National Sexual Assault Hotline number is 1-800-656-4673. Again, that number is 1-800-656-4673. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This morning, towns across Illinois are recovering from a series of severe storms and tornadoes that hit at least three different parts of Illinois yesterday and overnight. We know of one confirmed fatality in Ottawa and LaSalle County, another in the St. Louis area. White County in southern Illinois is another community recovering this morning. We're joined now by Bird Huber. He's a sergeant with the White County Sheriff's Department, about an hour east of Evansville, Indiana. Sergeant, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for taking the time for us this morning.
Thank you.
How are you guys coping this morning? What kind of damage are you all looking at?
Well, we're looking at a lot of electrical lines, electrical poles, structural damage. We did have one fatality, but it's all rural area. Very fortunate it went around one of our small little villages. So we were fortunate to only lose just one.
I'm sorry to hear that. Do we know, I don't know if we know the conditions under which that person passed away yesterday?
He was in a small trailer outside his residence, and the trailer, of course, was picked up by the wind, storm. Nothing's been confirmed yet, and then thrown, and he died from the injuries he received.
Sorry to hear that. Do we know, in terms of other damage, though, it sounds like you said everything else, where was it? I don't know if, and I guess it's hard to say at this point, too, if it was one tornado or how many there were. Does it seem like most of the damage was isolated to that particular incident in that area?
Yes. We're looking at probably, as the crow would fly, 7 to 10 miles, it was on the ground, and taking out anything in line structure-wise. A few lost some homes and barns. Things like that.
Okay. How big is your community in terms of, I wonder if you can give us a sense of the proportion of how much damage you guys have suffered?
Well, where the area is, of course, it's minor to where the whole area of the county, but like I said, fortunately it didn't hit any of the towns or villages in White County, but it's a very rural county, probably 14,000-15,000 total residents. And I'm thinking there's 500 some odd square miles in White County.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of help this morning, how are you folks faring? Who's out there to help with cleanup and pickup?
Well, we're very fortunate. Of course, when the first incident happened last night, we had numerous local police departments, ambulance services, fire departments. We couldn't ask for a better response from our local EMS. And then today, basically, we're just dealing with cleanup of the electric lines, electric poles, trying to get everything cleaned up, get the county roads cleaned up so that the electrical companies can get in and get the lines replaced. I think they said something like 80 poles they were going to have to replace, and that was just one. We have two different electrical companies that are involved, and one, I talked to a gentleman, he said that they would have to replace at least 80 poles.
Wow, okay. So damage, but thankful, as you said, that it was in a rural area. Our thoughts are with you guys. This is thanks for talking to us. Sergeant Bird Huber with White County with the Sheriff's Department. Thanks for taking the time this morning, Sergeant.
Thank you.
Bloomington-based State Farm is the nation's largest property and auto insurer, but last year they lost more money insuring cars than they ever have. In fact, the $7 billion auto underwriting loss reported in annual results yesterday contributed to an annual profit drop of a stunning 94%. Steve Daniels is a reporter with Crane Chicago Business who covers insurance. He's online with us now. Hey, Steve, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So, Steve, that's a huge loss. What more can you tell us about that?
I think it's very symbolic or emblematic of what's happening in the industry generally with a sharp increase in car accidents, and then the car accidents themselves being more expensive for insurers to cover. State Farm's by far the largest insurer of autos in the country, based insuring effectively about one in every three cars that there are. So what happens to them is certainly, a very, very important and to what's happening, generally speaking, in the industry. So that $7 billion auto underwriting loss was an eye-opener for sure, and explains a little bit why State Farm is hiking rates as fast as it is.
Right, because we saw that in January. We saw lots of announcements from insurers saying that they're hiking rates. Can we talk for a minute before we get to that about what is driving these massive losses? I know that you just mentioned sort of distracted driving. I can use myself as an example of this because I got rear-ended 2 weeks ago by a guy who I'm pretty sure was on his phone, although he did not say that. I just got my car back yesterday, actually, and I was surprised at how expensive all of it was. And it was just sort of, you know, it was a pretty simple accident. I was stopped at a stop sign, but he hit me because he was not paying attention, probably was on his phone. I'm not sure. But how much of that distracted driving is what's contributing to the rise in these claims?
Clearly a lot. I think when at the beginning of this, when insurers first started noticing this very significant increase in accidents, they were hesitant to say, to pinpoint distracted driving as being the main cause. It usually would be in a group or a listing of causes. I think increasingly we're seeing insurers single that out more than other things. Clearly there's more cars on the road. As the economy has gotten better, more people going to work.
Expensive cars, right? The cars, because of technology in cars?
Correct. Yeah, the cars themselves are more expensive to fix because the parts are more expensive. They're more sophisticated. And also medical costs are higher, too. So, insurers have to cover that as well. So it's just everything. It's the costs are higher, and there's more accidents. And clearly, I think distracted driving is probably the single biggest factor.
So, and are we seeing, this is essentially what we're seeing in terms of State Farm, particularly a trend in terms of underwriting losses? Because what are we looking at with 2015, 2016? Are we seeing this sort of a repeated amount of underwriting losses? Is this number, it's just getting bigger every year?
Well, it did with State Farm. Their underwriting loss in auto in 2015 was $4.4 billion, which also was a lot. It went up, 60%+ in 2016, and that was with the company increasing rates. So it's not as if they were doing nothing after 2015. For them, it's an issue. Now, State Farm there's a little bit of a difference in some insurance companies. State Farm's a mutual insurance company, which means it's owned by its policyholders. It doesn't have to answer to shareholders. It can afford losses more than insurers who are owned by shareholders, and whose shareholders won't really tolerate that. So in some respects, it's comforting when you look at State Farm's results to see that they did, in fact, still overall turn a profit.
Right, and that's an important thing to note. So there was still
absolutely
a $400 million profit in 2016, but that's a huge decrease from what it was in 2015, correct?
Right. But, I mean, the fact that they could absorb losses like that, and they were profitable on their homeowners insurance, too. So, there were rate hikes some years ago to try to improve the health of that business, and that is now healthy. In some respects, it's working like how it's supposed to for an insurer who is not owned by shareholders. That's one of the things that's for those mutual insurers that's nice, is they don't have to answer to those folks, and can in fact maybe not turn up the rate hike machine quite as much as some of the other ones have to.
In Illinois, what are we looking at? The biggest auto insurance rate hike in 15 years
right,
for Illinois?
State Farm.
Okay.
Right, the 6%, which for them is high. That's a noticeable rate hike. So clearly they're not comfortable with where they're at on their auto insurance. And in the past, insurers, and past mean 20 years ago, 30 years ago, insurers would be okay with these underwriting losses because they'd make it up on their investments, and they were reasonably confident that they'd be able to do that. This day and age, it's a little bit, the investment market is more volatile, and insurers don't want to have to depend on it to the same degree. So they really, at the very least, want to break even on their underwriting. And clearly State Farm didn't even come close to doing that. It's 18% higher in costs of various kinds than what they took in premiums on the auto line.
And just to be clear, you did say other units within State Farm did help make up that, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. Including a very nice investment return. So, 2016 was a good year in the stock market, and it helped them quite a bit. So that's kind of how it's supposed to work for a huge insurer like State Farm. So that's comfort. But again, they don't want to have to depend on that year in and year out.
Right. It'll be interesting to see about next year. Given that, what's the health of State Farm compared to some of their competitors?
Oh, they're very healthy. They're massive. I mean, State Farm was a publicly traded company. They'd be one of the top 25 companies in the land. They're financially very healthy. There's nothing to worry about there. It's just really how are they going in terms of managing their business? How are they going to respond on the rate front? They had in Illinois a very, very large rate hike just at the tail end of last year. What are they going to do this year? Obviously that's a state by state thing, and they're going to take different rate actions in different states. But I think with so many people insuring through State Farm, that has an impact. That ripples through. If you're paying substantially more for car insurance or homeowners insurance, that's less money that you've got to pay for other things.
And last question for you, Steve. We mentioned State Farm being the nation's largest property casualty insurer. Just thinking about auto and property, I think last night's storms are not going to help very much, right, in terms of claims that are going to be filed, not just across Illinois, but these storms were across the Midwest.
Right. No, that will not help at all on the homeowner's side. I think that you're seeing what's interesting and this is a different subject matter, but what you're seeing on the homeowner's side, at least in recent years, insurers are getting more used to these damages from tornadoes in the middle of the country.
Right.
And so in some respects, the climate change issue is hard for insurers to come to terms with because they responded to the hurricanes, Katrina 10 years ago by protecting themselves more on their coastal.
Well, and they pulled out of Florida. State Farm just left Florida. Sure.
Yeah, they ceded a lot of that to other insurers. But in the middle of the country, they're more exposed. So yeah, that could, depending, it's obviously it was February 28th. So we have tornadoes at the end of February. We're going to have lots more over the next 2-3 months, and we'll just see how that season unfolds.
Steve Daniels is a reporter with Crane Chicago Business. Obviously, we can't help tornadoes. We can help distracted driving. So it's a good lesson for all of us to put our phones down when we're in the car, right, Steve?
That is for sure.
Thanks for being with me.
Absolutely. Thanks.
And that's all the time we have for today. With all the storm news, we didn't have time today to talk about the new digital media company and site, La Vida Baseball, that launched today.
Hola!
La Vida Baseball,
where our stories are told.
Describe my country.
Awesome.
It's beautiful.
My father and my two grandpas, they are my heroes.
We don't really have a glove until we're like 10 or 12.
Like this?
They always ask me, what's my favorite dish? And I go, arepas, and they're like, what?
Rice and beans, chicken.
Say pollo.
You just got to get a chance. If you get a chance, you fight for your dream, and you'll be in the big league.
Our game.
Nuestra voz.
Our history.
Our story. Tell your mom and abuelita about it.
That's La Vida Baseball. Its editor-in-chief, noted baseball historian, Illinoisan Adrian Burgos Jr., was stranded because of the weather, but he's going to join us on the program tomorrow. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. And if you have Alexa, by the way, we're easy to find. Tell her. Ask Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All those links, every other way to contact us, whether it's phone, email, or social media, is at our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21st Show. That's 21ST Show. We live tweet with more analysis and background about the conversations we're having on the air. When we're off the air, you can follow us for the latest Illinois news. On our Facebook page, search for the 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on. You can post questions or comments that you want us to ask on air. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.